Okay, hello everybody. Welcome to Lecture 3. It's always a surprise that people are still with me this far in the course. One would have thought Lectures 1 and 2 would be sufficient to deter everybody, but apparently not. You remember I mentioned that Ethan says he's in for the long run. Well, remember, as Lord Cain said, in the long run, we're all dead. Okay, so you remember that I said in this course, I'm going to be giving a mixture of anecdotes and more theoretical material. This time, the lecture, again, like last time, will be more on the theory side. I'm going to try to give some of Murray Rothbard's contributions to economics. Of course, that's a very large subject. I just selected a few topics to talk about. One could easily give a whole course just on Murray Rothbard's contributions to economics, but I'm just giving one lecture on it. But I will give a few stories as well. Now, as you know, I'm sure all of you know, Rothbard's main book on economic theory is Man, Economy, and State. I hope all of you have a copy of that. You could easily get one, download one on the Mises site if you don't have it. Rothbard wrote this book. It was originally supposed to be a textbook based on human action. Remember, Rothbard had been attending Ludwig von Mises seminar at NYU since around 1949. He was tremendously impressed by human action. But as you know, for those of you who've read Human Action, it's not exactly the easiest book to read. It's a very difficult treatise. And Rothbard's idea was he would do a textbook account of human action, so it would be kind of give a simplified version of what was easy to read. At the time, Rothbard was working for the William Volcker Fund. Remember, I mentioned that in the first lecture. This was the leading sponsor of libertarian and conservative ideas. And one of the main purposes of the Volcker Fund, actually, was to help Murray Rothbard. It was specifically, that was one of the main goals that they had. Was they recognized Rothbard was a universal genius. He was a tremendous scholar. And they thought one of their main goals was to help him. So Rothbard wrote a sample chapter of the book, showed it to Mises, and Mises liked it. I think it was on Theory of Money. Mises liked it. So he proceeded with the rest of the project, but as he worked on the project, he changed what he was doing, he expanded what he was doing, so it wasn't a textbook account just of human action, kind of a human action for tiny tots. It would turn out to be a full-length treatise that was giving his own views as well as those of Mises. It was, incidentally, characteristic of Rothbard that he would start on a project that was supposed to be fairly not that long, or what you could call a bounded project, and it just expanded. This happened on his History of Economic Thought, which two volumes, I gave a course on that, both of those volumes, two courses actually, one in each volume, some time ago. And I'll tell you, not of course that I'm a gossip, but I'll tell you a funny story on that book. The book was originally commissioned by Mark Skousen. And what Skousen had in mind was that there was a very popular introduction to history of economics called The Worldly Philosophers by Robert Heilbronner. Some of you may have seen that. It's a very well-written short history of economics, but it's written from a very anti-free market point of view. So what Skousen wanted when he commissioned Rothbard to do this was a version of history of economics would be an answer to Heilbronner. And Rothbard came up with this long treatise that he was working on. He didn't do what Skousen wanted. Now, the Gossipius effort, you think Skousen would be very happy that he's getting this tremendous theoretical history of economics, this tremendous work, scholarly work on history of economics, but he wasn't. He thought, no, he's paying for this reply to Heilbronner, and that's what he wants. So I can tell you Rothbard and Skousen weren't on the best of terms. I remember on one occasion I was listening to a lecture by Skousen. I was sitting with Rothbard, and after I was listening to Skousen, I said to Murray, well, he doesn't exactly overwhelm one with his intelligence, does he? And Murray said, that's about, for our movement, that's pretty good. But enough of him. So, as I say, Rothbard expanded what he was supposed to be a textbook into this full-length treatise. Now, some people try to drive a wedge between Mises and Rothbard. Then people say, oh, well, Rothbard believed in 100% reserve and Mises didn't, and Rothbard was much more dogmatic than Mises. They'll say various other things. But what these people ignore is that Mises was still very much alive when the book came out. Rothbard's book came out in 1962, and he thought very highly of the book. He reviewed it. He was asked by the New Individualist Review to review the book. Remember, this New Individualist Review is this magazine set up at the University of Chicago, edited by Ralph Rako and Ronald Hanway. It was one of the great libertarian publications. So they asked Mises to review the book, and he said it was an epical contribution to the general science of human action, praxeology, and its practically most important and up to now best elaborated part, economics. Now he says, henceforth, all essential studies in these branches of knowledge will have to take full account of the theories and criticisms expounded by Dr. Rothbard. Now when Murray Rothbard died in 1995, the editor of National Review, William F. Buckley Jr., had a rather vitriolic obituary where he pointed out that Mises had criticized Rothbard a bit on some matters of ethics and legal theory, but he didn't say anything about this part of the review that Mises was very enthusiastic about, man economy and state. So now that's some of the background for man economy and state, but what I want to do now, I want to go over some of Rothbard's contributions to economic theory. And to do that, I first want to give a little bit on what is Austrian economics. You remember both Mises and Rothbard were great Austrian economists. Doesn't mean they come from Austria, although Mises did, but it's a particular approach to economics. So we want to first characterize what is Austrian economics. And I want to do this by comparing and contrasting it with neoclassical economics, which is kind of the standard economics you would get if you take a university course in economics, at least at an American or British university. Now, one thing you find if you study mainstream economics is often hard to understand. And why is that? Well, if you go into the subject in neoclassical economics in any depth, if you get beyond the introductory course, or sometimes even you will have this in the introductory course, you have to learn very complicated mathematical models. And why is it that raises the question, well, why do neoclassical economists want to use these complicated models? And one of the main reasons that they give is that they think this is a way to be exact in the sciences. We're concerned with exact knowledge, and if we have a mathematical model where we start with certain axioms and then show how various propositions or theorems are derived from those axioms, we can show formally how these theorems follow, so we have a very exact model, and they think this is a very scientific way to do, instead of just relying on ordinary language, which is sometimes vague and ambiguous. Does everybody know what is the difference between vagueness and ambiguity? Sometimes, I'm sure you know both these words, but what is the difference between vagueness and ambiguity? Anybody want to try that one? Yes, Jeff says vagueness is unclear. That's right. What about ambiguity? Yes, Malcolm says ambiguity may have multiple meanings. Yes, that's right. See, ambiguity is the word has more than one meaning, but the meanings don't have to be unclear, it's just that there are more than one of them, so you're not always sure what's meant. Say if you describe somebody as a very clever person, do you mean he's extremely intelligent, or do you mean he's kind of someone who's very tricky? The word can mean either one, so the word's ambiguous. So the neoclassical economists think if you use math and have set out your axioms, theorems formally, you can avoid this problem of the vagueness and ambiguity of ordinary language. Now, suppose you set up these models in the way they want. Well, then they've got to confront a question is, you can set up the very exact models, but how do you know that the models apply to reality? How do you know, well, you've got this very fancy model, but how do you know it has any relevance to the actual world? And what the usual approach of the neoclassicals, the mainstream economists, is say, well, what you do is from the model, you can derive certain predictions. You can say, my model predicts such and such, and then you can test whether these predictions come out right or not. And when you're testing the proposition of the model, that very often involves further use of math. There's various statistical techniques people have to learn. So sometimes you're reading an article, say, on giving statistical tests of a certain economic model. It looks like a railway timetable. They're having all these regressions and other things. I have no idea of what's involved, but you certainly have to know quite a lot of statistics in order to make sense of them. That would be a necessary but not sufficient condition for making sense of those tests. Now, there are some mainstream economists think that when you have a model, all that's important is if the model gives you true predictions. So we've got a certain model, you deduce certain things from it, these are the predictions, and you say, are the predictions true? So if you've got true predictions, then you've got a good model. And on this way of looking at things, it doesn't matter if the axioms of the model are true as long as you can come up with true predictions. So sometimes mainstream economists will use axioms that aren't true, such as that everybody always aims at maximizing the amount of money he can get. So suppose you use that, well, there are a lot of people who don't aim at maximizing money, but if it gave you true predictions, then it wouldn't matter, according to the neoclassicals, at least some neoclassicals, whether the axiom is true. And there's a famous article by Milton Friedman, remember the great economist at University of Chicago, the leader of the Chicago School of Economics, who defended this point of view. He said what's important in a theory is whether the theory, the model generates true predictions, not whether the axioms are true. I should say, again, giving you a little anecdote, as you may know, Milton Friedman and Rothbard really didn't like each other much, and Rothbard wrote an article attacking Milton Friedman. And as a result, Friedman's son, David Friedman, really didn't like Rothbard much, and he was very critical of Rothbard. So there's some, it's not just, this dispute is not just a matter, the dispute between Rothbard and Friedman is not just a matter of the proper way to conduct economic inquiry, it's also got very personal. So I say, the mainstream economists, at least some mainstream economists, not all of them, but some of them think you have to have exact mathematical models, and what's important is not whether the axioms are true, but whether you get true predictions. But the Austrian view is held by Mises and Rothbard is very different from that. Now, in the Austrian view, what's wrong with using mathematical model, other than the fact that you have to know math in order to understand it? And I should say that wasn't the problem for Rothbard. I mean, he majored in math in college. He understood the math very well. But when you've got a mathematical model, you don't really understand why things are true. You get the deductions just by following the rules of math. You can tell that a theorem will follow given certain axioms, but you don't have a real understanding of why this is a certain thing is true. You don't have understanding based on causality in the real world why it's true. You just follow the rule and you see, well, this follows from the axiom, but in the view of Mises and Rothbard, you don't understand why it's true. Incidentally, that same criticism that if you're using math, you don't really understand why things are happening. You just know that they follow from a certain assumption. That was the same criticism that Hegel made of Newton's physics. So I don't think that either Mises or Rothbard took this criticism from Hegel, but it is interesting, I think, that Hegel made the same point. Now, the Austrians don't agree with this view that what you're concerned with in economics is just coming up with a model and just following certain mathematical rules so you know the theorems follow from the axioms, but you don't really understand why the theorem is true. So what the Austrians favor is a method where you understand why each step of the argument is true. So you see, not only can follow certain rules and see why each step follows, but you understand what's going on. For example, this is a very famous one, we know we all act, we all use means to achieve ends. Say, if you didn't want to listen to me anymore, you could just shut off your TV screen, so you'd be using a means to achieve end. And in the Austrian view, if we think about what's involved in the concept of action, I say, we think about what's involved just in this notion of using means to achieve end, we can discover important truths about economics. So what we're doing in praxeology, which is this study of human action, you have to think about the concept of action, again, not using mathematical models, but just thinking about what's involved in the concept, and then if we're successful, we'll find out important truths about economics. Now, here's an example how we would do this. Suppose we have an exchange. Why would an exchange take place? Supposing you have some apples and I have some oranges, and you trade apples for oranges. Why would you make such a trade? Well, if you have apples and you want oranges, then you want the oranges more than the apples. And how we know that? Well, we just think it wouldn't make sense to make an exchange unless you wanted what you were getting more than what you were giving up. So it isn't that we do a survey of all exchanges or and ask people, well, did you really want what you were getting more than what you were giving up? We just think about an exchange and see what does this is involved in, what would be rationally required in order for an exchange to make sense. And then you would see you'd have to value what you were getting more than what you were giving up. So say if you want oranges, you have apples, so you want the oranges more than you want the apples. And if I'm willing to give you my oranges for your apples, then I want apples more than oranges, at least for the amounts I'm willing to exchange them. So we see, just by thinking about exchange, every exchange involves a double inequality. And so what's the significance of this is that just by thinking in every day about what an exchange involves, we've learned an important truth about economics. So we're just thinking about what is an exchange, and then we come up with some very significant result, an exchange involves double inequality. Now, what's so important about that? Well, there are a lot of, if you look at history of economics, there are a lot of people who didn't realize that. You think it's pretty obvious once you think about it that exchange involves double inequality, but there are a lot of economists who said, well, if there's an exchange, then the items have to be, exchange have to be equal. You find this, say, in Marx's labor theory of value. He says, well, if you have an exchange, say one apple exchanges for two oranges. So he'd say, well, one apple then is equal to two oranges. And then he said, well, how would you explain this equality? But you see, if you look at it from this Austrian point of view of double inequality, you don't have this problem at all, because there isn't an equality in an exchange. So you can see this is a quite significant result. Now, what we've done in going over this point about how we think about an exchange and then see that exchange involves exchange involves a double inequality, what we've just done is example of deductive reasoning. So what we're doing is we're asking, what do we need to make sense of an exchange? And then, as I explained, we'd see how exchange requires a double inequality. There'd be no point to an exchange unless each person in the exchange valued what he was getting more than what he was giving up. I've been giving these as so just two-person exchanges. I mean, if you had exchange among different, more than two people, you could apply the same point, because presumably all those exchanges would could be explained in as a series of two-person exchanges. So this is deductive reasoning. We're drawing out what's involved in a certain concept. We're not doing an investigation. We're not doing a survey. We're just thinking what's involved in the concept. And if we've done this correctly, then the results are true. It isn't that, say, as in the mathematical model, neoclassical, we're just starting with certain axioms and saying, well, we can tell certain theorems follow, then we have to find out, are the theorems true? What we're doing here is we're starting with a concept that we know already applies to the real world. After all, people do engage in exchanges, or people do act. So by thinking about what's involved in the concept, we know the results are true because these are part of the concept, and we know the concept actually applies to the world, so the results we get are true. Now, I now want to go in. That's the general background common to Mises and Rothbard, how, as both Austrian economists, of how economic theory works. So now, though, I want to go into, and this we're going to be giving, what is Rothbard's contributions to economics, a slight difference between them. Well, maybe it's not so slight. How slight it is, you'll have to be the judge, or how significant it is, you'll have to be the judge. But there is a difference between Mises and Rothbard on the method used in economics. Now, both of them follow this deductive method I just explained. That's to say, both will start with something that's considered evident or self-evident. What does self-evident mean? It means you don't need any further support from it. It's just something you see to be true. But they have, and then you deduce what follows from this, say, just as the way I'd explain with exchange, you see, well, what follows from the concept of exchange. So both of them engage in that sort of deductive reasoning. But Mises and Rothbard have different philosophical explanations of the method. So they both say, well, okay, in praxeology you have a deductive method, but they have a different account of what the basis of this method is. What Mises says is that we have a priori concepts. And what is a concept? It's an idea that you have in your mind. Say, there's action. I have an idea of action. You have an idea of action. It's concepts you have in your mind. And what do you mean by saying that they are a priori? A priori, you can see from the word, it suggests prior, before. So the concept, it's an a priori concept, is one that's prior to experience. So how could you, what does Mises mean by saying the concepts are prior to experience? What he means is that unless you had these a priori concepts, you wouldn't be able to understand experience, or at least part of experience. For example, suppose we don't have the concept of an exchange, then, say, if you're looking at, out at the world, you would see, say, people making various motions with, say, with their arms, say, see one person passing an apple to another, another one passing an orange to the first person, see what's going on. Unless you had the concept of exchange, you wouldn't understand what's going on. So what Mises says, and we're not going to go into right now whether he's correct about this, but it is his view, that he thinks unless you had these concepts before experience, not necessarily before in time, but you have to have them before understanding the experience. You wouldn't be able to understand the experience. It's something like, what's a good way of looking at this? Supposing you're looking at an algebra book, you see all these equations. Unless you understand some of the concepts of algebra, you won't know what's going on there in the book. You'll just see some symbols, but you won't be able to tell what's going on. So Mises thought this is true for experience in general, at least experience relevant to economics. You need to have certain concepts such as action in order to make sense of what's going on in experience. Now there's a view on theory of knowledge that was very much influenced by Kant, who you remember Ayn Rand referred to as the machine gunner of the mind, but while he was machine gunning the mind, he developed some interesting views on theory of knowledge, and his view influenced Mises very much. So again, Mises said we have a priori concepts. Now, Rothbard has a different approach. Remember, Rothbard doesn't think we have a priori concepts. He thinks, and this is a view those of you who know Ayn Rand's philosophy will be familiar with, he thinks we get concepts by abstraction from the empirical world. Say, we see a lot of different tables out in the world, and we can say, what are these objects have in common, so we can get a concept of a table from that. So you see, if you have that view, it's very different from Mises, because Mises said at least some concepts, he doesn't say this about all concepts, he said some concepts, such as action, you can't get by abstracting from experience. Now, why not? Well, supposing, say you saw people acting, you see, say, one person is giving a lecture, somebody else is punching somebody else is giving an inaugural address as president. You say, could somebody, an empiricist would say, couldn't you get the concept of action just by abstracting from all these activities and say, well, they're all using means to achieve ends. That would be what an empiricist would say. But the court Mises would reject that. He says, no, if you don't already have the notion of action, you wouldn't be able to get this concept of action just by generalizing or abstracting from particular action. So Mises thinks this concept is a priori. It's before experience. You need to have this to understand a particular aspect or realm of experience, and Rothbard said you can get this concept, all concepts come from abstraction. The position that Rothbard had on this, that concepts come by abstraction from the empirical world, is one that comes from Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas. They, of course, borrowed their theory from Rand, but now Malcolm says can some concepts come from a priori and others through experience? Yes, I mean, certainly that would be a very interesting way of looking at things. I mean, that may well be true, but in Mises, I don't think held that all concepts are a priori, just that some of them are. Now, you might think, well, Rothbard's in a bit of difficulty here, because he says all concepts are empirical. But remember, the Austrian economists, including Rothbard, very much including Rothbard, say that the propositions of economics can't be false. Suppose I go back to the one I was talking about before. I said an exchange, every exchange involves a double inequality. Each person values what he gets more than what he gives up. So in the Austrian view, that's true. I can understand that to be true just by thinking about the concept of exchange. But if concepts are just empirical generalization, how would I be able to say that it's always the case that an exchange involves a double inequality? So it looks like Rothbard's in a little trouble. But what Rothbard says is, the way he gets out of this, he just says, even though the concepts are empirical, all the concepts come from experience, including the concept of exchange in action. We can grasp that certain propositions not only are true, but have to be true. They are necessarily true. So the way Rothbard was doing it is slightly different from Mises. Instead of saying, we're thinking about the concept of exchange and say, well, we think about the concept, we see exchange involves double inequality. Rothbard says, the concept of an exchange is an empirical one, but suppose we take the statement, the proposition, the judgment, every exchange involves a double inequality. We can see that one is not just true, but it couldn't be false. It's not just something that might be true, might not be true, such as let's consider the proposition, I'm now giving a lecture about Rothbard. Well, that's true because I am now giving a lecture about Rothbard, but it didn't have to be true. I could have been giving a lecture about something else or not giving a lecture at all. But it couldn't be false that an exchange involves a double inequality. So even though the concept is empirical, it's still true that the proposition about that uses this concept can be necessary. I see Malcolm asked a very good question. Did Rothbard think that all concepts are empirical and that none are a priori? I don't know that he said that in just those words, but it's certainly part of the Aristotelian Thomist view that he held, and that would certainly be something both Aristotle and Aquinas held, that all concepts are derived by abstraction. I thought it's a bit, there are some scholars of Aristotle and St. Thomas who don't think abstraction is the best word to use for their view of concepts, but none of them think that think that Aristotle and Aquinas believed in a priori concepts in the way that, say, Kant did. Okay, so in the Rothbard's view, we can directly grasp, for example, that human beings act is true and must be true. So we could get the concept of action by empirical generalization, but we can see that the statement, proposition, human beings act is true. Now you know the difference between a concept, remember, is just an idea that you have in your mind, but a proposition is an assertion. It's saying something is the case or isn't the case. It's predicating something of a subject. So a proposition is different from a concept. So in the Rothbard's view, concepts are empirical, but there are some propositions that are necessarily true, or not just true, but couldn't be false. So in Rothbard's view, once we understand this statement, human beings act, we understand that it's true and it couldn't be false, it's one we don't need to test further. We just think about what the proposition means and then we realize it's true. So it's an a priori truth, meaning what does a priori truth mean? Well, here, this is a little tricky. I want people to pay extra attention to this because this is a bit involved and a lot of people miss this. When we're talking about a priori truth or a priori propositions, it's different from a priori concepts. Remember, an a priori concept is one that you have to have in order to make sense of the experience or certain realm of experience, such as in Mises' view. If you don't have the concept of action, you won't be able to understand all sorts of things of what people are doing. So the a priori concept is something that you have before experience. An a priori truth is different. A priori truth doesn't matter how you get to the statement that's a priori true. It's one that you don't need to test any further in order to realize it's true. So suppose I say there are less than 50 people listening to this live lecture. Well, that's one I couldn't find out if it's true just by thinking about the statement. There are fewer than 50 people listening to this lecture. I can tell that because I can look in this little box and see how many people are attending. But I couldn't just find that out just by thinking about the statement. But if it's an a priori truth, then I can do that. So I think, let's look at human beings. That I don't have to start looking at particular people saying, well, does this one act? Do I act? Do you act? Does Obama act? Does Speaker Boehner act? I just grasp the statement. I see that it's true. So here, this is a very important point to get, this basic difference between Mises and Rothbard. Both Mises and Rothbard accept a priori propositions, but only Mises accepts a priori concepts. And here, there's a subtle difference between how Rothbard and Mises start economics. Say, in human action, Mises starts from the concept of action, says what's involved in action. And Rothbard starts from what he calls the action axiom, which is a proposition that human beings act or man acts. And one point it surprised me, Danny Sanchez called this to my attention, is Mises never refers to an action axiom. He's talking about the concept of action, not the action axiom. Rothbard talks about the axiom because, remember, he doesn't believe in a priori concepts, but he thinks they're a priori propositions, a priori true propositions. Now, Andreas asked an interesting question. Does Rothbard hold any necessary truths other than economics? Yes, I think he would. Again, this is part of, because he's in Aristotelian Thomist in philosophy, that's certainly part of that philosophical view. There are necessary truths in metaphysics, theory of knowledge, not just in economics. Now, okay, that's one of Rothbard's contributions in the economic methodology. And I now want to go into a few contributions he made to economics itself, not just how you do economics, but what is involved in the actual theory. Now, one of these, I think one of the most interesting of Rothbard's contributions, involves Mises' socialist calculation argument. Now, do people here in the class know what the socialist calculation argument is? Have most of you studied that? Or Oh, good. I'm getting some yes answers. Good. So that's good in a way that this material will be familiar to you, but it's bad for me because I can't just make it up. You'll be able to catch me out if I say something that's wrong. That's always a bit daunting for a lecture. Now, what Mises argued, famous article that came out in 1920, Labor's extended in his book, Socialism, 1922, was an essentially planned economy couldn't work. Well, why not? Well, there, in a developed economy, there are factors of production that have multiple uses that aren't just determined by technology. For example, suppose you have steel. How are you going to use the steel? Maybe you could use it to make cars, or you could use it as a steel plates in people's heads, or you could use steel to fill teeth, as I think they do in Russia. Some dentists have, people in Russia sometimes have steel fillings in their mouth. So there are a lot of ways you could use steel and other factory production that are technologically possible. So the question comes up, well, how can you use these in a way that'll get you the most of the goods you want? Of the goods you want to have produce as much as possible. So what's the best way to use those factory production so you can get not just the most goods quantitatively, but the most of goods that you value? What would give you the best combination of goods that you can get? And Mises' contention was that unless there are market prices, there's no way to settle the question of what's the best way to use the factors of production. That was it's one of the great contributions to economic thought in the 20th century. What Rothbard added to this is that the calculation problem isn't restricted to socialist systems. So what Mises said is, look, at the time of the Russian Revolution, 1917, and after, people were saying, socialism is really great because instead of having this irrational process of having everything produced on the market where there's no central plan, we're going to plan everything scientifically. So won't things be much better under central planning than under the market? In Marx's phrase, we're getting rid of the anarchy of production. A lot of people believe that. Nowadays, people who favor socialism usually give arguments based on ethics for socialism. They say, well, it's very unfair, say, that a CEO makes 5,000 times more than his workers, or Bill Gates has enormously more money than the socialist who's protesting about this stuff. So you have now arguments for socialism are usually based on ethics, but before Mises wrote, or before the Soviet economy collapsed, the main argument for socialism was it would work better than capitalism. You're able to be much more productive because it's scientific, it's based on a plan. And Mises overthrew that because he said, no, you can't have any economic calculation unless you have real market prices. Now what Rothbard added was the calculation problem isn't restricted to socialist system, so that you'd have a calculation problem in a non-socialist system in this way, that let's consider not the whole system, but individual firms within an economy. They need to have market prices in order to calculate. Say, let's imagine a particular steel factory. So they want to know what is the best thing to do with the steel they produce. Now they can have some things that they say, some things they produce within the firm, but in order to know whether what they're producing within the firm is a good use of that as compared with other uses, they need market prices too. And Rothbard argues, well, there couldn't be one big firm that runs the economy. Remember, one of the standard Marxist arguments was, under capitalism, the small firms will be driven out by larger firms, and everything will be dominated by monopoly, and you might get the monopolies will consolidate further. But what Rothbard pointed out was, well, you couldn't get one big firm that was running the economy, because then you'd run into the same kind of calculation problems that Mises pointed out for the socialist economy. And this isn't just a purely theoretical interest, because you say, well, there's no prospect of one big, or getting near one big firm that's running the economy. But Rothbard said, as a firm gets bigger, it will face calculation problems. So there's a limit to the size of firms in a free market. The calculation problem will apply to them if they get so large that they don't have market. If they try to produce things in goods internally within the firm, if they don't have access to market prices, they won't be able to tell how well they're doing. And I want to I'm jumping to another area that Rothbard made an important contribution in economics, and this was his criticism of Lord Keynes, who was one of the most influential 20th century economists. Now, what Keynes said was that in a depression, government spending is needed to get the economy to revive. So, say we have now 7.8 unemployment. Well, Keynesians such as Paul Krugman say, okay, the government has to come in and start spending more. Why, we can ask a question, why would government spending get the economy going again? The Keynesians think it would. Well, why would it? One way it might, according to the Keynesians, or at least some of the Keynesians, is supposing the government starts spending more and the wages the workers get don't rise. Nominal wages, meaning the wages in money, don't rise. So then what's happened? Well, when the government spends more, it's increasing the amount of money in the economy. We're assuming it's not just getting the money by taxing it away from people. It's, let's say, the Fed has increased the money supply. So when the money supply increases, then the value of the dollar, the monetary unit, goes down. So if nominal wages don't rise, real wages fall. Real wages is what you can get with your money. So if your money, let's say your money wages stay the same, but prices have gone up, you won't be able to buy as much, so your real wages have gone down. You see, it's like, you remember this famous joke where somebody is in a coma for 20 years, and he wakes up and he finds there's $10 million in his wallet. So he thinks, oh boy, I don't know what happened, but I'm multimillionaire now. And then he goes into a restaurant and he orders a bowl of soup. Say, okay, gets his bill at $2 million for the bowl of soup, so he's not doing as well as he thought he was, even though he has a high nominal amount of money. He doesn't have such a high real amount of money. So what happens then if real wages fall? Well, then employment will increase. And why is that? Well, if you study elementary pricing, you know that when the price of something falls, then the quantity demanded increases. If we wanted to get more people in this course, say we lowered the admission rate, you'd probably get more people in the course. I've given a couple free lectures, like I gave one on Henry Hazlitt's book on ethics. I got several hundred people who attended that because it didn't cost anything. So here, wages are going down, real wages are going down, employment is going to increase because employers will demand more. So this is one way a Keynesian idea could work, that the government spending is reducing real wages, so it's increasing employment. In depression, people are unemployed, so this is increasing employment. So the standard criticism of that is that's just a way of tricking workers into accepting lower wages, and it's not very likely to work. Workers are pretty wise to such things, and they'll just react by asking for an demanding increase in nominal wages to compensate for the increase in money. Now, there's some Keynesians who say, well, if you said the way to get an unemployment in a depression is to lower wages, this really wouldn't help, because in a depression, people, even if wages are lower, people just will stop spending money because they think prices will fall further. People just hoard or withhold money from circulation. So that's why, in this Keynesian view, you need more government spending. So even if workers were willing to accept wage cuts, many Keynesians say, you still need government spending because people are in a depression, just not going to spend money themselves. They'll just be waiting for prices to fall. Here's where Rothbard's contribution comes in. He says, suppose that happens. People are waiting for prices to fall, so they're not spending. Rothbard says, well, then that'll just allow the true market prices to reach more rapidly. So that isn't a reason to have a government come in and start spending going. If people are expecting the price to fall further, that'll just get prices to fall rapidly until prices lower to a sufficient rate to get people to start spending. Rothbard wasn't the only economist who pointed that out, but his contribution was to say that's a good idea. It's a desirable way of getting the market to get back to get back to the market prices. So he's countering Keynes at one of the central points of Keynesian views. Now the last topic I want to get into, and again there are many more talks one could have discussed, but this is the last one I'll have time for, is what's called welfare economics. Here I want to focus especially on an important paper that Rothbard wrote in 1956 called Toward a Reconstruction of Utility and Welfare Economics. Now, what's involved in welfare economics is this. Economists very often want to criticize the free market, say, oh, well, such and such is wrong with the free market, it's too much inequality, there won't produce enough public goods, various other things are wrong with it. But they want to do so in a way that doesn't involve appeal to controversial value judgment. So suppose somebody in economist said, well, there's too much inequality because I don't like inequality. I think people should be equal. Somebody else could say, okay, you think that, but that's not scientific. That's just your personal preference. Who cares about what you think? So what welfare economists try to do is say, is there some kind of way you could come up with ways of suggesting the market needed to be changed that didn't involve appeal to controversial value judgment? And one suggestion that welfare economists came up with was called the Pareto criterion, named after the great Italian economist and sociologist Vilfredo Pareto, who at various points in his life was both a libertarian and a supporter of Mussolini's fascism. What the Pareto criterion says is, if a proposed measure makes at least one person better off and no one worse off than it meets the Pareto test. So let's suppose somebody gave one of you $10. Everybody else stays the same. So the person got $10 would be better off. Nobody would be worse off. So if that were the case, then this would pass the Pareto test. So people, the welfare economists who want to criticize the free market sometimes use this Pareto test as a way of trying to come up with measures to criticize the market. And there are extensions of this that we won't be getting into here, other tests like the Kaldor-Hicks, but I don't want to go into some of these details. If you're interested, you can look at Rothbard's paper. Now, what Rothbard does is he challenges these welfare economists on their own ground. He said, the criterion, Pareto test criterion says, if a measure makes at least one person better off, no one worse off, and it passes the test. So Rothbard said, well, how do you know if a measure will make at least one person better off and no one worse off? He says, in economics, we have to use demonstrated preference. Remember, I spoke about that in the first lecture where Rothbard was concerned with, was influenced by this notion of operational definitions, which is terms in science have to be given very exact criteria so we can know they apply or not. You have to have ways of knowing whether a certain concept applies to the real world. What Rothbard said, well, to have a scientific concept of preference, we have to just take preferences demonstrated in action. So we would know any market transaction passes the test. Because remember, we already covered this when I talked about double inequality. You won't have a free exchange unless all the parties to it expect to benefit. So you won't be trading apples for oranges unless each person values what he gets more than what he gives up. So in an exchange, we'll pass the Pareto test. Now you might object, if the people who are engaged in the exchange will both expect to benefit because otherwise the exchange won't take place, but couldn't some market transactions make people worse off? Like, the example, suppose, let's say, you've enrolled in my class, so I'm better off because I need to have people in the class in order to make money, and you're better off because you wanted to take the class. But what if somebody doesn't like me or wants me to fail? So couldn't you say, well, that person's going to be upset because I'm benefiting, so doesn't this transaction make that person worse off? Well, that might be so, but in Rothbard's view, we can't use such feelings in economics because they aren't a demonstrated preference. Say somebody might just say, I'm giving the lecture, but he's not doing anything. Unless there's some action, we can't use the preference in economics. So for economics, scientific economics, the way Rothbard conceives it, we're just interested in preference demonstrating action. So we have free market exchanges pass the Pareto test, but no measures of government intervention pass the test. Because remember, you have a government intervention, government saying, you have to do such and such, or refrain from doing such and such, or will use force against you. And if the government uses force to make you do something, then you haven't demonstrated a preference for it. Say, the government says, we'll put you in jail if you don't pay your taxes, then you haven't demonstrated that you want to pay, when you give the money, you haven't demonstrated that you want to give the money. You've just demonstrated you'd rather give the money and go to jail, but you haven't demonstrated that you like, you want to give the money to the government. So what Rothbard uses the standard Pareto principle, which the wealthy economists use to criticize the market. So he turns it around and says, if you adhere to this principle strictly, then you'll get an argument for the free market, not against it. So I guess that I just tried to give you just a few of the contributions Rothbard made to economic theory. So I think now we'll have questions and discussion for the rest of the time we have. Objections are always welcome, especially ones I can answer. Now, Malvin says, Rothbard wrote an article detailing the present state of Austrian economics. Has anyone written an article updating the state? I don't think it's comprehensive. I think Joe Salerno has some stuff commenting on various developments in economics. I don't think there's anything exactly like what Rothbard did. Andre said, did Rothbard later reject anything he said on economy and state? I think there are a few details he would have expressed differently. I think there's some points on where he's distinguishing the final state of rest and the evenly rotating economy. And I think he accepted some of Joe Salerno's points that some of the terms weren't exactly right. But basically, I don't think he did change much in his way of thought. Now, Bob says, how has praxeology developed since Rothbard's passing? Are there any articles discussing the historical development of praxeology, how to learn the methodology? Well, I think it's developed just in the sense that there are economists who try to continue Rothbard's views. I think there are other people written on praxeology, like Hans Hoppe has some stuff on it. Roderick Long has some very good stuff on praxeology. Are there articles discussing historical development? Well, I think you get that. Yes, I think you get that in some of Roderick Long's work, and I have a short pamphlet on philosophical origins of Austrian economics, I think it's called. I gave a lecture, but of course I haven't read it in a long time, but I think that would be one, would have some sources there, and how to learn. Well, I mean, you just read this stuff and get into it. I don't think there's a special method of learning it. You know, you just read it and do the best you can on it. And it's not that hard to pick up. It's just simple common sense reading. That, I'm glad you asked, of course. This is a point Mises made very strongly. He thought that when his deductive method wasn't some kind of innovation of his, it was kind of a standard way economists reasoned, at least up to the time he was writing. It's kind of a standard commonsensical way of reasoning. You just say what's involved in these different concepts. And you can see if you take elementary price theory, kind of non-mathematical way, you still can see it's very often basically done in accord with praxeological ideas. People say, well, you wouldn't, if there's a price if sellers charge a higher price for what they're selling than buyers are willing to offer, then there'll be a surplus of the product, or if the price is below what people demand, there'll be a shortage. So in the way you establish that is just by thinking about supply and demand, just reasoning out what's involved deductively. So that Now, Mao says, have there been articles written that detail the problems and how they manifest for firms that get big with a calculation problem? I think Peter Klein has some stuff on that. Yes, I think he's one. He has in his book on the firm, has a book on the firm that where he goes into that. He has two books. I think he would be the best one there. Now, Jeff says, why is the difference between raw power needed and a priori proposition versus a priori concept important? Well, it's just that they have, it's two different views of the matter. I mean, you might say they come up with the same, basically the same conclusions of why does it matter. It's just if you think this is an important philosophical issue, sort of what is the nature of knowledge, is our knowledge, do we have a priori concepts, then it's an important difference. I mean, if you don't think that's that important, then you wouldn't rate it so important. But I mean, just if you say, in philosophy at any rate, how we get concepts is an important issue, so the difference there is important in philosophy, but in actual economics, it wouldn't be so significant as long as you're coming up with the correct conclusion. Because remember, they're both accepting a certain way of doing economics, but they're just coming up with different explanations. But why is that view correct, or why will that view reason in that way give you true propositions? So there is this difference between them. I mean, how important it is be something that really you'd have to evaluate for yourself, depending on how important you think this issue is. So the difference, Mao says, the difference would manifest themselves in philosophical thoughts that are developed from that point on. Well, it would be philosophical thought, but not necessarily in economic theory. It would just be in philosophy. I mean, it would certainly get you into other philosophical differences. Now, Leslie says, doesn't David Friedman use deductive arguments in the book? I'm like, yes, very much so. I mean, it also can say he's certainly reasoning in a way that's in accord with praxeology in his book on price theory. That's a good point. Andre says, has there been an Austrian college textbook like the one Rothbard set out to write? I don't think so, actually. No, that's a very good, I think there's a need for that. I think, there is one. Yes, I forgot, stupid of me, characteristically stupid. I think Sean Rittenauer at Grove City has such a book. Yes, I forgot. It's a very good book, too. I stupidly forgot that. Well, I'm quite old and senile, so I forget things. But I think Sean Rittenauer, Rittenauer, has a book that's basically an Austrian college textbook. Chris says, is there anything you can add about the animosity between Rothbard and Friedman? Let me see. What Rothbard wrote an article about Friedman, more or less saying that Friedman wasn't that much of a supporter of the free market. He did support the free market in a lot of ways, but he deviated a lot. Say he was one who came up with the idea of withholding tax during World War II. There are a lot of areas in which he had a role for government. And they also differed very much on how they accounted for the 1929 Depression. Remember, in Rothbard's theory view in America's Great Depression, 1963, he applied Austrian business cycle theory. So basically, in his view, the Fed inflated during the 1920s, and then the Depression came about after the boom, the inflationary boom collapsed. The view of Milton Friedman in his Monetary History of the United States, written with Anna Schwartz, was the real problem with the Fed was not expansion during the 20s, but that the Fed contracted when the Depression started, and that worsened things. So they really disagreed there also. And I think they didn't have much personal contact, but Rothbard did have some contact with Friedman's son, David Friedman. I think according to one story, Rothbard once kicked Friedman out of his apartment, and they really clashed. And Friedman written articles suggesting Rothbard is dishonest in his use of sources, and that was another area they didn't agree on. Craig says Rothbard at least described Friedman great in everything except money. Well, he had other criticisms of him besides that. He has an article on Friedman where he goes into, but I mean, if Rothbard's law, which he referred to as people always write the most on what they're worst at. Now, Andrea says a bit off topic, and I missed last week's class to ask this. I assume you mean there you missed asking this in the class last week, not that you missed last week in order to ask the question now. Just a joke. Is Rothbard's idea of children right taking to follow from self-ownership, or is it something extra? I think he thought it was somewhat, it's one, he was sort of asking, given you accept self-ownership, what would be a position you want to take about children's rights, given that children don't have a capacity for full self-ownership? And that, what he gives in the chapter there is his answer. But I don't think he claimed that his results followed deductively from self-ownership. It was just, with self-ownership in the background, what would be a reasonable way of looking at the question? That was what he came up with. And he wrote, actually, I think I mentioned last week, he was somewhat under the influence of Bill Evers there. It's a very controversial chapter. But I don't think, if, say, you didn't care for that idea of children's rights, you wouldn't have to reject self-ownership. He doesn't claim to establish that his view of children's rights follows from the notion of self-ownership. Now, on that, how Malcolm says, have any Austrians written different views on the ownership trustee relationship between parents would have to a born child? If so, who's written on it in their views? Well, one minor point, although this is one that's very important to bear in mind, this is an issue of libertarian theory. Austrian economics is just a view of theory of economics. It doesn't have any direct implications for political theory. Now, on the question, it's a very good question you asked. I don't think there's been a large literature on that. There's actually John Locke had some stuff on rights of children that was different from Rothbard, but I don't think that this is, I mean, I'm probably just ignorant of the literature, but I don't think this has aroused an enormous attention among Austrian theories. It's certainly a very difficult topic, but I don't know really anyone who's addressed that much. There probably are some, I'm just not thinking of them right now. Now, Leslie says, where does Hayek stand on the issue of a priori concept? Well, he has, in his book, Sensoriori, he has a rather a view that there's sort that there the mind is has certain classification schemes that are based really on neurobiology. So he takes a priori to mean something like innate. Now, a priori, the way Kant has, does not mean the same as innate, but Hayek takes it to be sort of that people have these innate ways of classifying things, so they're a priori in that sense. And I see a difference between innate and Kant's sense of a priori. In Kant, an a priori concept is one you need to make sense of a certain realm of experience. It's not, has nothing, it isn't a biological concept, but it is in Hayek's view. Now here's a long question here. Let me see this one. It looks interesting. At least it's on. Morley says, free exchange, both people better off, or ultimately happier. Satisfied. I'm free exchange. I can exchange my money at the point of the gun and benefit by saving my life. Both the robber and I are better off, but I'm left with feelings of resentment and not greater satisfaction as a result of the exchange. You have a free exchange, ultimately increased satisfaction of both parties. A coerced exchange necessarily ends in one dissatisfying party and the other satisfied. Could you comment on how we can't use such feelings in economics? Well, as Rothbard was suggesting in his article, what you say may very well be true, but the problem for that Rothbard would raise, I think, with what you're suggesting is the notion of how your feelings and feeling, say, I think you're right, if somebody put a gun to my head, I wouldn't be feel very good about it. But according to Rothbard, that is just something that's in my mind. It wouldn't be a scientifically usable concept. What Rothbard would be saying is that someone robs you, the point is not that you don't feel good about it afterwards or you're resentful afterwards. It's that from the fact that he's forcing you to going to shoot you if you don't give him the money, you can't apply the principle you would be better off you're better off giving him the money than say you can't well let me how should we put this. You can't deduce from that absent the coercion, absent the his threat to shoot you, you can't deduce you're better off giving him money. Of course, he's better off getting it, but you can't deduce that you'd be better off giving it to him because if he hadn't threatened you, you wouldn't have given him the money, whereas in a market exchange, the people are doing the things voluntarily, so you can say, well, they're demonstrating that they both want to do this, but that isn't the case in a coerced exchange. So the difference from the way you're interesting, what you're suggesting is it isn't going, the argument isn't going through particular feelings such as resentment or satisfaction that people have in the exchange of things. What are their actions? What do their actions show? And Craig says, I can understand why the power and market section was cut from the MES Bank. Why was publication power and market delayed for so many years? Well, I think one reason they just had to get the money to put it out. I mean, it wasn't just, they just needed to raise the money for it. And also, if we have time, can you comment on how Francis Bacon, utilitarians, affected thought and their connection to positivism? That's kind of a very broad topic. I think that that's such a broad question. I'm not sure I could say anything useful to it. I don't. With Bacon, of course, you had the was very important in the development of inductive method, scientific thought, notion of very important of improving people's estate, their condition. This is something you find in utilitarians also, but I don't think I could really say much useful about it. Not that you're asking a very good question, but it would require a very long answer that I don't think I could give right now. And especially, I think I have about 4 minutes left. Anything good we could say, funny to say that, Francis Bacon was reputed to have the worst case of bad breath in Europe, at least in Western Europe at the time, just as Henry IV in France had the smelliest feet. But that isn't a good answer to your question, but I mean, that's what comes to mind in the little time we have left. Now, Andrea says, how long did it take you to read Mankind's State when you first read it? Well, I mean, that would go back to 1962. I think it took a few weeks. I'm not really sure, but I think so. I remember I was very impressed with the book, but I don't really remember how long it took me to read it. Skousen says he read MES on his honeymoon. I suppose probably didn't have anything better to do. Andre said, any last funny Rothbard stories? Well, definitely a subjective choice. Let me see something pretty good. I think I mentioned he really didn't like Bob Nozick at all, and I think I told you about one. I can tell you one that's kind of funny. He really didn't. At one time, was very close to Roy Childs, but then he definitely really hated Roy Childs, and I was thinking of something he said, but I better not say that he really didn't like him. Let me see if I could give you something else. Oh, one I remember, kind of funny story. He disliked President Clinton so much that Joey, his wife, had to stop him from kicking in the TV set when Clinton would come on. Oh, Ethan did require the same restraint with Obama. So you get a kick out of Obama. Okay, well, I guess we're out of time now. So thanks. I hope we'll see you all next week. Thanks a lot, everybody.